I don't always show my appreciation or excitement. I am a little bit like one of our elders in that way. And I want to say, just come out and say, we've been here for several weeks now, and I don't always show it, but I really do appreciate you all and thankful for how you've welcomed us. With sermons, you've given me proactive feedback, and I look forward to more of that. I appreciate that. I need that. It helps me to know where I can grow, and it also helps me to know my audience better as well. And I especially want to say I'm looking forward to getting to know all of you better. I don't know all of you well, and really looking forward to getting to know you better. I'm hungry for that. We've been here for several weeks, and it's like, I really haven't got to talk to everyone well yet, so looking forward to that. I thought it would complement the sermon this morning to have a lesson on authority, but not as we might normally think about it, but as it applies in our roles, in our leadership, in people, what Christ-like authority looks like in us. There are plenty of concepts about what good leadership is, but good concepts, effective concepts about leadership in the world may or may not be useful in the kingdom and as God's people. Effective leadership doesn't equal good leadership. Getting people to do what you want them to do doesn't mean it's actually good Christ-like leadership. I'm reminded of a show where a friend is, this guy has a public speaking occasion ahead of him, and he is very afraid of this public speaking occasion, and his friend is going to help him with this event by saying, you know, I'm going to give you some notes. I'm preparing for this speech. And so he gives him some speaking tips from Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler and people like that who were, you know, effective leaders who got the job done. They got rallied people, motivated people. So he gets all ready for his speech and he pounds the podium and he waves his hands and he yells and shouts at the audience and they seem to really like it. The point being that effective leadership, again, is not necessarily Christ-like leadership, just because people got people to do what they wanted them to do, doesn't mean it's what we should be doing. I'm not a leadership expert, but I can look at the gospel, I can look at the cross of Jesus and say there's some essential aspects of leadership that we've got to have. No matter what tactics, strategies, tools you use, it needs to be like Christ in any realm of leadership that we can exhibit. In Genesis 49, I'm going to be in Genesis for this lesson. In Genesis 49, we're kind of starting with the end of this story of Judah. In Genesis 49, he's speaking, Jacob, the patriarch Jacob, is speaking to his sons, giving them these blessings. And they function as blessings, but they also function as prophecies and really predictive. They really say what's going to happen. It's going to be for these sons of Israel, these sons of Jacob, and the tribes that come from them. And so we're going to read Genesis 49, starting verse 8, because Judah is selected as a leader, and people from him will be leaders and kings. And we're going to kind of take this his story in Genesis to try to appreciate why God would choose Judah. But you can see that he has in Genesis 49 and verse 8. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion. And as a lioness, who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He has washed his garment in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. The scepter will not depart Judah. And he's going to be this line of humble leaders who ride donkeys instead of great white horses, but leaders nonetheless. And his robe will be washed in blood, wine, it says, but I think that's an image of victory and conquering, and so his garment is washed in wine. But why Judah? As you go through and look at chapter 49, he goes from Reuben and Simeon and Levi all the way to Judah, because that's the age order here. Judah is not the firstborn, which was the typical one with the responsibility of leadership. Judah's not the firstborn. So why does God choose Judah? And not just Judah personally, but his line, where David comes from. And so many, and all the kings of Judah, all the kings from David on, excepting the northern kingdom of Israel. Why Judah? I do think he chooses Judah because he exhibits a particular leadership quality. So let's go ahead and look at Genesis to kind of gather this. So we're going to go all the way back to chapter 37. We're going to pick up pieces. Judah's story is kind of scattered throughout and interlaced with Joseph's story that we're very familiar with. And so I hope I'll depend on that a little bit to be able to capture Judah's story. But chapter 37, you can catch on to some of his leadership skills in chapter 37. Let's read verses 25 through 28. Joseph has had these dreams about how his brothers will bow before him. He's received that fancy coat, and his brothers obviously have been jealous and upset with him. He goes to check on them, and they devise a plan to be rid of him. They want to kill him, some of them do. And Judah comes with a deal to solve this problem. In verse 25, "Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh.' And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt." Well, there you go. There was a problem. They didn't know what to do. They weren't all in agreement. Reuben had interceded for Joseph. Don't kill him. We'll learn a little bit more about his motives behind that. But don't kill him. And so we don't want to kill him, and we have to conceal his blood or have his blood on us. But we also don't like him. We don't want to keep him around. So what can we do? Well, here's an opportunity. And he persuades them to make this deal. And they do. And it's like, we could kill him and have to hide it. But here, we can even make a profit off of him. After all, he's as if it really matters that he's our brother. He kind of throws that in there. He's our own flesh. So let's not kill him. Let's make a profit on his life and sell him. Well, don't worry. I'm not actually going to say that this is why God has chosen Judah. Really, Judah's not looking like a godly leader here, is he? In chapter 38, we get to see it focuses in on Judah. This is a difficult, sad chapter. It's one of those ones you might just skip in a kid's class and just follow the encouraging story of Joseph. Just don't bother with that lone chapter that interrupts the very exciting, encouraging story of Joseph. But actually, it invites a contrast. When you read chapter 38 of Genesis with Judah, it really invites a contrast with what Joseph is doing and how he keeps on getting opportunities to lead. Not because he seized it, but because God gave it to him. But look at what Judah does with his position of authority as a patriarch and a father in chapter 38. Let's read verses 1 and 2. "It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur." Not particularly anything of note on the surface, but as you're reading Genesis, you realize that marrying Canaanite women tends to mean making a choice toward paganism and away from the one true God. And so it's not shedding positive light on him, and I wouldn't make such a stark judgment on him, except that you see where it leads. And so verse 4, "She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son and called his name Shelah. Judah was in Kezib when she bore him. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the seed on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. This may not seem relevant. We're talking about leadership, and all we're talking about here is his family. As Christians, as we read the scriptures, we should know that how a person handles his family and the fruit of his family is a great indicator of what kind of leader he is. He married a Canaanite woman, and he produced children who did not honor God, who were wicked, not just kind of sort of wicked, but they were wicked enough that God struck them down dead. I mean, how often do you see God, it's saying that God just struck them down dead? And that's what happens with these two sons. They're just rebelling against God's will here. Eldership, you know, they have to have faithful children to manage the household well, to be men who are one woman men, faithful in their marriages. Judah is having a lot of family problems here. But then he's a man who solves the apparent problem for Tamar's sake by making a promise. And there you see it, another common leadership trait, making promises. We've seen a lot of that. Midterm elections, that's what elections are all about, making promises, because a promise makes people feel okay for the time being to get the results we want now. And hopefully we'll deal with actually bringing about those promises later on. But for now, we really just want the results of the promise. We want people to kind of appease, in this case, appease Tamar and appease God by making a promise. Well, that's fine. And again, I'm being a little bit judgmental, but it's because I'm looking at it in retrospect, because how does this promise end up turning out? Continue in verse 11. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah, to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come in to you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And he said, if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give to you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When you especially notice verse 14 there, each individual is responsible for their own sin. But we cannot deny the influence of our sin, especially the influence of leadership on the sins of others. Why did she decide to get up and go pretend to be a prostitute? Because Judah failed to keep his promise. He said, I'll give you my son when he's grown and ready to be married. Never happened. And you have to understand that for her to make a living as a widower twice, I don't know who wants to marry her, twice widower, and God struck her husband down. She would have a hard time. No children, no husband in that culture. She would have a hard time. And so she can take matters in her own hand. It was wrong. It was sinful. But Judah put her in that situation. She could have done something different. She could have been faithful. But he, no doubt, influenced her to sin. In verse 20, we see how he deals with this. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the man of the place, "Where is the cult prostitute who was at Enaim at the roadside?" And they said, "No cult prostitute has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her." Also the man of the place said, "No cult prostitute has been here." And Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her." He needs to get rid of this friend, first of all. Go ask about it. And his friend goes around the town, and he's saying, "Okay, enough asking around about where the prostitute is. People might make a connection between you and me, and I will be laughed at." And then he finds out about Tamar. I want you to imagine how this might have gone if she wasn't pregnant by Judah. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Okay, so if Judah hadn't done this and she just got pregnant, how do things end up? Judah was sleeping with a prostitute, but no one has to know. She was being promiscuous, and she's pregnant. Just burn her. The hypocrisy, the obvious doubled standard. Of course, she has evidence. In verse 25, "As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, 'By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant.' And she said, 'Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.' Then Judah identified them and said, 'She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah.' And he did not know her again." And she had proof, evidence. These people know that this stuff belongs to you. So he's not executed. He recognizes his hypocrisy and that his sin is the greater sin. It's all sin, but it's the greater sin. It's the worse sin. She sinned because of him in the first place. But at least there is a glimmer of hope here. And I'm saying we're going to try to figure out why God chose Judah, but so far, it's like, why did God choose Judah? Why in the world did God choose Judah? He's a mess, especially as you're in this bright spot of Joseph and all his faithfulness. In chapter 39, what do you read about Joseph not doing? He's faithful in Potiphar's house. He's entrusted with everything in Potiphar's house. He's in a position of authority and is given an opportunity to, in a worldly sense, increase his authority by sleeping with his boss's wife. And he resists. He flees. Joseph is just this complete opposite of what Judah is here. And yet, he gets blamed for it. Judah here, the bright spot, though, here is just the beginning of things turning around because he did finally admit it. Now, you might say, okay, of course, he's got no choice. Well, people can deny anything. And so there is at least some humility in the fact that he is confessing. For all I know, another more carnal person, more committed person to his sin might have just tried to wing some kind of deceit at this point. Still tried to put it all on her and not on himself. But he does at least. It's not like I'm saying he's a wonderful guy now. I'm just saying at least he admits to it and has the humility to do so. So far here, I want you to appreciate that he is not a worthy leader. And none of us are. That we don't make ourselves adequate. Paul talks about that in 2 Corinthians 3. None of us are sufficient. None of us are adequate. We're only adequate if God makes us adequate. And that's what God's going to do with Judah. You see, it's going to have to involve quite a transformation for Judah to get there. But God does bring him there. We're kind of skipping over a lot of Joseph's section here. We're going to pick up again with Judah and some of in the 40s in chapters 42 first off. But You know, Joseph, again, he keeps on going through discouraging things. He's thrown into more than one pit in his life, and is faithful in any place he is. He trusts God. He endures, and God keeps giving him a position of authority. And he ends up going to be second in command of Egypt. And so God is with Joseph as he's patiently enduring these things. And you don't hear anything about Judah for that time. But in chapter 42, I'm jumping ahead a little bit. I want to raise the question about the other brothers, the brothers that are older than him. Because we're asking about Judah, but again, the pecking order goes, the firstborn is first consideration for leadership. And so why not Reuben, I wanted to ask. And why not Simeon, and why not Levi? Well, you can read in chapter 35, verse 22, Reuben, his way of trying to gain leadership and influence was by sleeping with his father's concubine. His father shouldn't have a concubine, Bilhah, but he does. And again, a cultural way to supplant someone else's, undermine someone else's authority and assert your own was to sleep with her woman. Not the kind of leadership we're looking for. Simeon and Levi, in chapter 34, their sister, Dinah, has been seduced by Shechem, another Canaanite, and they're not happy with that, obviously, and they make a deal with Shechem and his people, and say, you know what, you can have our sister, and we can all intermarry. Just one condition, you guys got to get circumcised. Okay, you know what? We'll do that, and then we'll be able to assert our influence over the nation, and their stuff, their people will be our people. And so they agree with that. Shechem's people agree to that, and so in chapter 34, verses 13 and following, Simeon and Levi, well, I guess it's later in the chapter, Simeon and Levi, on the third day after they've been circumcised, they go through the town while the men are dealing with their circumcision, and they slay every man. They're probably dealing with their circumcision with some painkiller. And so they're an easy foe to defeat. This was not justice. It was vengeance, disproportionate, completely disproportionate. The offense against one woman exacted it on this whole people, killing all these men. The kind of thing you might watch an M.L. Gibson movie and cheer on a hero, you know, what clever, what is really glad, kind of clever, you know, here, get circumcised and then we'll kill you all. But not God's justice, not God's justice. And in chapter 49, that reflects that's shown in the promises and the blessings that Jacob gives. Some of these blessings, man, don't really sound like blessings. Genesis 49, you can see what he says to Reuben in verse 3. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the firstfruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, unstable as water. You shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi are brothers, weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company, for in their anger they killed men. And their willfulness they hamstring on oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. You notice you don't really, can't always identify Simeon's territory in later portions of their history. God is not happy with how they exercise leadership, and so they're not chosen. So how about Judah? You know, is he going to try to find one of these carnal ways? Or is he going to really be changed? And so, in chapter 42, to catch up on the scenario a little bit, Jacob and his family, really the world around, is experiencing a famine. And so Jacob sends his sons that remain to Egypt, because Egypt, by God's providence and working through Joseph, has stores of grain through this famine that they saved up by God's revelation, knowing the famine would come. And so go to Egypt. And they go to Egypt. They meet Joseph. Joseph recognizes them. They don't recognize him. He's changed a lot. He's probably looking very Egyptian, but he recognizes them. He accuses them of being spies. He questions their story. He knows they're not spies. He knows who they are, but he does want to know two things. Is my father alive? And is this younger brother you speak of, is he really well? Is Benjamin okay? And is my father, Jacob, okay? And he doesn't reveal himself. He sends them back. You can't come back here unless you come with Benjamin, his younger brother. But there's this dilemma. No one can convince Dad to let Benjamin go because, well, things didn't go well when he sent Joseph in their hands. He doesn't know they killed him, but he died. He knows Joseph was killed. He thought Joseph died when he let Joseph go. So no way. No, I'm not letting this other son of my favorite wife, multiple wives, not letting him go. So how do we persuade Jacob to let Benjamin go? This is another leadership question, influence and persuasion. Well, look how Reuben goes about it. Again, taking a shot at being a leader here. Chapter 42 and verse 36. I finally got you to chapter 42. And Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me." Then Reuben said to his father, "Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol." I mean, it's quite a commitment to make. It's this promise, this oath that puts a curse on his own family. If I don't keep this commitment, you can kill my two sons. I mean, it sounds like he means it. It's really actually sad commentary that Jacob doesn't go with it. Maybe he knows Reuben isn't really a man of his word, that he wouldn't actually kill his two sons, or maybe he doesn't think Reuben thinks very well of his two sons. I'm not sure, but it's not persuasive. It's interesting, Reuben does not say, "You can kill me." Reuben says, "You can kill my two sons." It's like, "Hey, Dad, to prove that your son won't get hurt, we'll just kill your grandchildren if he does get hurt." I just don't know why that he thought that would work, but it doesn't work. And I think maybe Reuben is known as someone who isn't willing to really watch out for others at his own risk. And so his real reason, I think, in protecting Joseph in the first place, don't kill Joseph. In chapter 37, when he had found that Joseph was not there, the big question, chapter 37, verse 29, is, "Oh no, where's Joseph? What's going to happen to me? Joseph is gone. You guys must have killed him. What's going to happen to me?" Not, "How's Dad going to take this?" or "Too bad for Joseph," but "What's going to happen to me?" And so I think maybe that's the way Reuben is known. He's going to watch out for himself, which means he can't really be counted on to give his life for the sake of Benjamin if it came to it. So he's not persuaded. And so they continue to rely on the grain that they have, and eventually it comes around and they're out of grain. So we got to do something about this. We got to make a trip to Egypt. Go back to Egypt. Well, we can't go back to Egypt. We can't go back to Egypt to get more grain without Benjamin. And so we've got, again, to deal with this and to persuade Jacob. Look at how Judah approaches it. Chapter 43. Let's jump in verse 8. "And Judah said to Israel, his father, 'Send the boy with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be a pledge of his safety. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever.' If we had not delayed, we would now have returned twice." See the difference between those? "You can kill my two sons," versus, I bear the blame. You exact vengeance on me. Of course, it's just a promise. It's just a pledge. It's a strong one, because it comes with this oath, this curse on himself, personally. But Judas made promises before. But I will say, it is the persuasive one. Perhaps because of need, perhaps because of Judah's more persuasive pledge, Jacob says, okay, go ahead, head your way. And you think, you know, nothing's going to go wrong. That's what I think I'd be thinking. We're trying to convince Dad, but at the end of the day, it's going to be okay. And what are the chances things will go wrong? Well, things go wrong, and very intentionally so, by Joseph's hand, by God's hand. In chapter 44, we're going to read really the whole chapter, because I just decided summarizing it wasn't going to do it justice. We're just going to read the first 17 verses for now, to just see the scenario, what happens here, how Benjamin gets in a tough spot. Chapter 44, verse 1. Then he commanded the steward of his house, "Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain." And he did as Joseph told him. And as soon as morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. Now Joseph said to his steward, "Up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this.'" When he overtook them, he spoke to them these words. They said to him, "Why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money that we have found in the mouths of our sacks we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Whichever of your servants is found with it shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants." He said, "Let it be as you say. He who is found with it shall be my servant, and the rest of you shall be innocent." Then each man quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack, and he searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell before him to the ground. Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination?" And Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also in whose hand the cup has been found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." So they had brought Benjamin, and now they're going to make a trip back. They had previously been given the money they had paid for their grain in a previous trip, and they were really nervous about that and brought it back. We just want to make sure, you know, everything was good on the books. We bring in this money back. Joseph has set up the situation. And if you're Judah, it's hard to know what to think right now. It's like, what? At first, it's what are the chances? But then you realize, well, he did this. Benjamin did this. From Judah's perspective, he doesn't have the backstory we have. He doesn't know Joseph planted this. For all he knows, Benjamin, the idiot, has stolen this special cup of divination from Joseph, from this great, powerful leader in Egypt. I had one job, to bring you home safe, and now you've put yourself in this position. You put me in this position. I don't know. I'd be thinking about a way out. Because it was one thing to pledge my life in place of my kind of nice brother. It's quite another to pledge my life in place of this fool who just got himself into trouble. I didn't make the pledge with that in mind. And so we'll get back, and surely between the 10 of us, we can overpower Dad and not keep this pledge, or say, hey, look, the pledge, you know, had this no foolishness clause. Surely there's some way to get out of this. That's how I would be thinking. There's got to be a way out of this. Because Benjamin looks guilty. Let's read verses 18 and following. Then Judah went up to him and said, "Oh, my lord, please let your servant speak a word in my lord's ears." Of course, lord here is just a respectful term, a master. "And let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said to my lord, 'We have a father, an old man, and a younger brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead, and he is alone, left of his mother's children, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him.' We said to my lord, 'The boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die.' Then you said to your servants, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again.' When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my lord. And when our father said, 'Go again, buy us a little food,' we said, 'We cannot go down. If our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down. For we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us.' Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I have never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm happens to him, you will bring down my gray hairs and evil to Sheol.'" Verse 30. "Now therefore, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now therefore, please, let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." Reuben, you know, when Joseph's missing, "What's going to happen to me?" Judah at this point is saying, "What's going to happen to our father? We'll bring his gray hairs down to Sheol in sorrow." And then, let me stay in his place. They were all going to be allowed to go free, innocent. But let me stay in his place, this fool who got us into this situation. Let me be a pledge, a ransom in his place. I hope that sounds familiar. Because we're looking at Judah, and we're seeing this is the characteristic, I think, that puts Judah in a position where God says he is going to be the tribe in which the leaders, the kings, will come. This self-sacrificial pledge that came out as a true commitment that he carried out, to sacrifice like that, to give himself as a ransom. There's a greater king that comes from him. There's a greater leader that comes from him. The Lion of Judah, Jesus. And in this case, Benjamin, well, we know he didn't actually deserve it. It wasn't actually his fault. It was all set up. That's not the case with us. We really are the fools who got ourselves in this situation. We really do deserve to be cast out of God's presence for eternity. But Jesus, knowing that, is a ransom for us. You can turn to Mark chapter 10. It'll be the last passage we work with. Mark 10, verse 42. In our leadership, in our influence, you cannot manipulate or domineer. Don't just assume that things that work are things that make a good leader. Self-promotion, manipulation, false promises, backbiting. We see it the world around, in every realm of leadership. We've got to resist those things and be willing to suffer for the sake of the people we're leading. That is the only way it's going to work out as a faithful leader before God. We're going to lead people who are imperfect in our families, in churches, in our workplaces, in anywhere. And it's going to hurt. And they're going to do things that will have us bearing the cost. But that is what Judah was doing. And that is what good leadership, Christ-like leadership, will have us do. And we can. We can do it. Not because we are this endless vat of grace that's just being poured out, but because we have that endless vat of grace from Jesus. We have God's love and grace that He suffered for us. And so we can keep on giving to those in our care because He's given us far more than we could ever give. So in Mark 10, it uses language that I think will go well with what we saw with Judah. James and John, these brothers, have approached Jesus or gotten their mother to approach Jesus to ask for positions of authority in the kingdom. Hey, when you come into a kingdom, we want to be on your left and on your right. And Jesus addresses their carnal idea of leadership in chapter 10, verse 42. And Jesus called them to Him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom